Thanks for listening to one of our Sunday messages at Crossroads Bible Church. We gather on Sunday mornings at 9:15 and 10:45 a.m. To find out more about our church or to connect with any of our ministries, visit our website at crossroadsbible.org. We hope you enjoy the message and pray it encourages you as you follow Jesus.
Blessed are the meek, and why we're calling this Family Rhythms, if you've missed a couple weeks in the series so far, is because when Jesus outlines what it looks like to follow him, sometimes he calls us into action. But for so long, I think the church has not done a good job of differentiating between where the action starts. And we've taught for too long that the action starts in a place that ends in the appeasement of God or the earning of the favor of God. We don't believe that. Here, we believe in something called grace. And what that means is, when we go through our list of the things, of the family rhythms in the Beatitudes, blessed are, here are some character traits. We don't do those things because we're afraid God gets mad at us. We do those things because we're already in the family of God, and they're the rhythms of the new family we're in, you know? And so we have asked some of the staff to share some of their family rhythms, and I'm going to share one today from Stephanie Thrasher. It's fall in Texas, which means what it means everywhere. Christmas is coming. And everywhere you go, we've forgotten the other holidays because I don't know why. It makes me upset. That's a whole other thing, though. But I walked in Hobby Lobby the other day. Guys, I have spent time in Africa, in Europe, and Haiti, and I literally felt more at home and comfortable in the middle of Africa than two steps into Hobby Lobby, all right? It just doesn't, my soul starts going crazy. There are no signs on the aisles. I feel like I'm lost in some TV show of torture. It's just not my style. It makes some people really giddy. I don't get you, right? But when you walk into Hobby Lobby, there's all this Christmas stuff everywhere, and it got me thinking about our Christmas rhythms. And if you're like me, and if you're like my childhood, if you have kids or have had kids, sometimes Christmas, especially the morning of, is kind of like trying to push against running water. If you say to your kids, let's wait to open presents, you know? You have all these kids, and they see these presents over time build up, and they shake them, and you tell them, don't shake the present, and then they try to guess, and you tell them not to guess, and then Christmas morning comes, and it's all you can do not to have them eat one another before they try and open the gifts that you spent time wrapping, right? So this is what I love about Stephanie Thrasher's Christmas experience. She wrote it out for me, and I'm gonna read it, because it's really good. She was an only kid, and her Christmas rhythm with her family blew me away. She said this. She said, since I'm an only child, we always had the luxury of quiet, slow Christmases. We would wake up and gather at the lit tree and sit and admire my dad's beautiful work. It's already different than mine. He was quite creative, spending hours each night leading up to Christmas, decorating each gift to perfection. Some gifts would have elaborate bows and ribbons. Some would have affirming or beautiful words written in calligraphy. And I remember that one had a complete train track on its top. It gets better. He didn't do this for attention. He did it because he loved the look on our faces as we admired how much time he spent on them. It was him showing his way of how much he loved us. Then we began opening the gifts. My parents would number the bottom of the gifts to ensure they gave me the gifts in the perfect order, ending with the gift I was hoping for the most. We'd take turns opening a present, pausing to admire it, discussing the gift that was purchased for us and why, and giving hugs and thank yous to the gift giver. What is this family? It's not done. This was such a long process. We'd usually pause in the middle to make pancakes, snowman shaped, of course, and eat and just take in the morning together. There literally was an intermission, right? It was just such a special day because it wasn't completely about the gift. She says, and now that both of my parents are gone, Christmas morning with them is a memory I will always treasure and hope to incorporate with my family once they're old enough to appreciate it. Family rhythms, what they do at their core is they try and build into us the things that we want to be, that matter to us. So when Jesus talks about the Beatitudes, he's saying this is who we are as a family of God. This is what matters to us. But sometimes, and today's one of them, those rhythms that reflect the family that we're in seemingly push against the culture, like pushing against rushing water, you know, like Stephanie's Christmas experience. Because what Jesus does is he gets up there to his people in Matthew chapter 5, and he says in this text to begin, "Blessed are those who mourn." And you got to understand, before we get in any deeper, the context of his people. So he's preaching to a bunch of Jewish men and women. And for years and years and years, they'd been oppressed. Right now, in our text, in the first century, they're oppressed by a Roman Empire. And Jesus is just starting his ministry. He's starting to teach and to preach and to heal, and that's attracting attention. And so they said, "Tell me what you're all about." And he says, "Sit down and let's talk." And he starts the Sermon on the Mount. And he says, "Blessed are, hear the rhythms of my kingdom. This is who we are." And in a world about a people group that just wanted to own the land they were sitting on right then and there, but they didn't because the Roman Empire did, he says to them, "Blessed are the meek." He says to a world back then especially thirsty for power that traded in the currency of influence, he says, "Blessed are not the powerful, but blessed are the meek." And all these people wanted, these men and these women and these children, was to own the land they were sitting on again like they did when David was around. They groaned for their freedom. My kid is 7 weeks old, and every night we put her to bed in this thing called a miracle sleep sack thing. It's amazing. It's a miracle. Do you know why? Kids want their hands above their face, but when they put them up here, they punch themselves in the head and wake themselves up. They don't know what's good for them. And so you literally have to, it's sad but funny at the same time. This is a miracle swaddle because it has these two little flaps that pin her arms down with the body weight of her back. So when you wake her up in the morning to change her, you open the flap, and she is writhing to get free, you know? I mean, she sits there and squirms, and sometimes I'll wait a second. My wife's like, "Charlie!" And I'm like, "Oh, sorry," you know? That's the Jewish people under the hand of Rome. They were groaning for their freedom, and they thought Jesus might be the beginning of the deliverance they'd hoped for, and he sits down with them, and he says, "This is what I'm about. Blessed are the meek." And when we talk about blessed, like we have in the weeks past, blessed is more than just happiness. It's joy. It's self-sustained. It's more than just physical. It's also spiritual. We're going to see that in the text. Blessedness really is this idea that as you live into the principles of God, your life reflects his family and leads to life. Blessed are. But it doesn't look like you think it does sometimes. Blessed are the meek. That's not what I expected, nor what I wanted. Stott says it like this. He says, thus the followers of Jesus are to be different from both the nominal church and the secular world, different from both the religious and the irreligious. Calvin says, we are happy in the midst of miseries, for our patience is blessed by the Lord, and we will soon be followed by a happy result, talking about what it means to be blessed. He says, the disciples of Christ must learn the philosophy of practicing their happiness beyond the world and above the afflictions of the flesh, what they thought they needed and wanted. And that's where we are today. It's a blessedness that comes not from the unseen. It comes not from the so often practiced principles of the world around us, but it's the ones that seemingly fight against our happiness instead of bringing our happiness into fruition. And we dive into this idea of meekness. Meekness. It's probably the last thing that the Jewish people wanted to hear. They were sitting down listening to Jesus talk about his coming kingdom that they were hopefully going to reign and rule finally again. Blessed are the meek. It's like pushing against running water. And there's a tension there. I think that's their tension. I think our tension is a little different, but kind of the same. I think meekness isn't a talked about characteristic in the Christian world sometimes, you know? I think you have your top three, love, joy, and peace, right? You have your 1 Corinthians characteristics. You have your fruits of the Spirit that if we said as a Christian, give me 5 words to describe me, I'd want it to be love or joy or peace or maybe faithfulness. I mean, the big ones, the heavy hitting, the sexy fruits of the Spirit characteristics, right? Meekness is not one of those. I think meekness sometimes gets lost. It's like my twin brother growing up. We've talked about him before, and he was all the things I wanted to be, 6'3", blonde hair, blue eyes, and athletic. And I was mildly athletic, but I'm a 5'9", white guy. And so that limited my potential a little bit, you know? And growing up in high school, my brother's a very good-looking dude. And in high school, I was a high school kid. I just wanted girls to notice me, you know? Like any high school kid, I was terrified they wouldn't, or they would laugh at me and all those good things. And so I had girls stop me in the hallway. Often, and they would say this, "Charlie, do you know how hot your brother is?" And I would say, "No, tell me." And Literally, they'd say, he is so hot. And I'd say, this is good for me. I'm a middle child. I have complexes already. And then they'd say, you are really cute though. You are really cute, right? And I'd say, thanks, that made it better, right? My point there is I think meekness is the cuteness of the fruits of the Spirit, right? I think meekness is maybe not something that we aspire towards, but something we default into and are okay with it. I wonder what it would look like if meekness is something we aspire towards like the other ones. Because as Jesus is listing out his family rhythms, this is the first one he says that has an effect on all of us together. It goes from vertical to horizontal right here, right now. Why does he say meekness first? It seems like he places a higher value on meekness than I think you and I might in the Christian subculture that we live in today. And then two, I think meekness is difficult for us because we don't have a good description for it. Meekness is a tough word to define. It's slippery. Somebody described it to me this week like. And not in a bad way, but we have all these words to describe the words in the Bible. If you didn't know this, the Bible is written in Greek. That's not English. And because it's a different language, they have different words that mean different things. And the job of translators, which have done an amazing job, is to say, here's this Greek word, it means this in English. And sometimes we have in our language towards other languages, we have different words to express different nuances that other languages don't have. So for example, in the Greek, there are in the Greek, in the first century Greek, the Conine Greek, there's six words for love. Four of them are seen in the New Testament. We have one, right? So when translating, what you have to do is say, okay, this is the kind of love they're talking about because they have more words for this concept than we have for this concept. That's meekness. And so sometimes in your scriptures, and we're going to go there today in Numbers 12 and Galatians 6 and Matthew 11, you'll see words like gentleness or lowliness or humility or patience. And those words are the same word we're seeing here because meekness is a concept that's really nuanced that we don't necessarily have language for. And so what I would like to do today is hopefully round out the idea of what meekness is. And then look, when we leave here, I don't know if I'm going to be able to give you a definition that's 10 words or less that you can hold on to. But what I want to be able to do is round out the nuance of the concept so we see it when we recognize it when we see it. And maybe then we can aspire to be it more, you know? So Jesus says, blessed are the meek. And a couple things as we start this conversation. The first place I started was who is meek in the Bible? Where does it say this person is or isn't meek? And if you go to Numbers 12, it's probably one of the clearest examples we have of what meekness is. So often I think, like I said, it's kind of slippery and we need to define it well. And so in Numbers 12, literally in verse 3, it says about Moses, this guy is the meekest man, same word there, that has ever walked on the earth. Your versions probably say gentle or patient or lowly. The meekest man that ever walked on the earth. So I'm going to dive into that text for just a sec and ask the question, what is meekness and what made Moses meek? So it starts, let me just read in verse 1 and 2. Miriam and Aaron, those are his brother and sister, spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. Verse 2, they said, has the Lord spoken only through Moses? Has he not also spoken through us? And the Lord heard it. Verse 3. Now the man Moses was very humble, that's meek there, more so than any other man on the face of the earth. So here's what we see. We see this story. What God's doing is he's juxtaposing some characters. We have Miriam and Aaron, and really it's mostly Miriam that's leading the charge there because the verb in that first verse is feminine, and so it's describing her action, and Aaron's with her. And so it's saying that Miriam went and challenged Moses. And what you see there is it's probably Moses' second wife, and he married a Cushite woman. And so that happens, and what you kind of see is this power play between Miriam, Aaron, Moses, and the new wife. Because Miriam was the first lady of the people of Israel. She was the sister of Moses. And when he married again, she gets a little threatened, and she says, why can Moses be the only one that hears from God? Aren't we here too? Because for years and years, God spoke to Moses. God did miracles through Moses. People looked in reverential awe on who Moses was. And finally, she looks at Moses and says, I'm here too. Why can't God use me? It's this idea that my pride and my insecurity drives my actions and encounters with others, the horizontal line. And the first thing we have to see about meekness is that actually meekness is absolutely opposed to pride and insecurity. Meekness begins with a concept of humility. And so the Lord meets with him. If you keep reading, it says in verse 4, the Lord immediately spoke to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. It says the three of you come to the meeting tent, and then God does business with his people, and he challenges Miriam, saying, "Why would you question my prophet?" And then in verse 9, it says, "The anger of the Lord burned against them, and he departed." Verse 10, after the cloud had departed, that was the presence of God, from above the tent, there was Miriam, leprous like snow. Then Aaron turned towards Miriam and realized that she was leprous. And in the Old Testament, that's a judgment of God. He's saying, "I don't agree with what you just did." And so what we see in this text, fundamentally, before we get into what made Moses meek, what you see is what meekness isn't. And it's not pride. Because Miriam and Aaron stood by Moses and watched him do all these things, and they probably asked the question, "Why not me?" And really, we have to understand that pride and insecurities are kind of two sides of the same coin, because what you pride yourself on is probably where you get your value. And when those things fall well short, insecurities rise up in its place. It's the second side of the coin. So my point here is simple. If you want to know where you're not meek, find where you're prideful. Find where you're insecure. That is juxtaposed to the man of God in this text that is meek, Moses. And so he says it's not all about you. And so what I want to do, what I think is important with kind of a conceptual character trait, is what does that look like for you and me here and now? How do I see meekness every day? You know? And as I was thinking about it this week, I think if meekness is the antithesis of pride and our insecurities, I think those things manifest itself every day in our conversations. There's a reason why the first one that relates to all of us is blessed are the meek, because it's the fabric that holds our family together. We have to remember that it's not about me in every conversation we have. But that's hard. I was listening to a podcast and a TED Talk from a woman. She's a public radio broadcaster from Georgia. And she wrote a book. Her name's Celeste Headlee. She wrote a book called We Need to Talk, How to Have Conversations That Matter. And I love that idea in a world that I feel like is losing the art of the conversation. So I was listening to her TED Talk, and she was talking about, because she has conversations for a living on the radio. She was talking about how to have good conversations with people. And she says, I'm just going to read it. She said in her TED Talk, number 6, she had 10 ways. Don't equate your experience with theirs. If they're talking about having lost a family member, don't start talking about the time you've lost a family member. If they're talking about trouble they're having at work, don't tell them how much you hate your job. It's not the same. It's never the same. Experiences are individual. And most importantly, it's not about you. You don't need to take that moment to prove how amazing you are or how much you've suffered. What it's not saying is don't relate to people. What it's saying is, and I do this all the time, I need to recognize it, is when somebody's talking to me and I hear a story, I'm thinking in my head, "Oh, I got one that's better." You know? I'm thinking in my head, "Oh, you did that? Oh, let me tell you about this." And in that moment, what I do is I forget to listen to others. But it's bigger than that, because I make that moment that they're sharing their experience not about them, about me. It's my pride and insecurity welling up. And it happens every day. There's a therapist, his name is M. Scott Peck, he's pretty good. He said, true listening requires setting aside of oneself. And so when we talk about what meekness is, it is the fundamental idea that it's not about us. It's humility. And that's juxtaposed to what Moses was. Look at verse 3 again. It says, now that man Moses was very meek or humble or patient, more so than any other man on the face of the earth. I love the way it describes Moses. And so it got me thinking, what makes Moses meek? And if you know the story of Moses, he was a prince in the most powerful place in the world to that point, the Egyptian Empire. He ran people groups and big projects. And then for 40 years, he disappeared and went into the wilderness. He went from running people to looking after sheep. He went from having a high profile job to having the lowest profile job. And in that moment, God finds him, kind of broke down his pride. It took 40 years. 40 years. If you think you've mastered it, check again, right? So he's walking with the sheep. You guys know the story. It's Exodus 3, and he looks over. There's a bush. It's on fire, but it's not being burnt. And Moses is blown away by that. He's in awe of God, and then the bush speaks in some way, shape, form, or fashion that terrifies Moses, because it would scare us too. And he knows it's the presence of God. He knows that God is there in that moment. And this is what happens. This is what it says in verse 10. So now go, I'm sending you, this is God, to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt. He's being blown away by the presence of God, watching a miracle of God happening right in front of him. He's not doubting the ability of God to send him. He's doubting himself. It is unabashed humility of what do I have to bring in this moment to save people I don't think I can. It's not about me. Even when you're saying, go do this. And this is what I love about the rhythms and the Beatitudes is they build on each other. So for the first couple weeks, we laid a foundation of understand your perspective in relation to God's perspective. And then once you understand what you bring to the table, be sad about it. Only having that point to how good God is. Don't stay in sadness. And then now he's saying that should filter out into how you treat other people, the fabric of your family, as you are meek in your conversations. It is the very base point of how we deal with one another. There's a theologian, Arthur Pink, he said, first, there's a poverty of spirit, a sense of my insufficiency and nothingness. Next, there's mourning over my lost condition and sorrowing over the awfulness of my sins against God. Following this, an order of spiritual experience, is a humbleness of soul. It's the beginning of meekness. Humility is the proper perspective of yourself in light of who God is, and it's the beginning of meekness every single time. So when we approach a concept like meekness, where do we begin? We begin with humility. Where is it not? It's not in your pride and insecurity. Know that. Dig down, dwell into those things. And say, even in those things that make me prideful or want to be insecure, I know that I need meekness in those areas of my life wherever that might be. So meekness is humility. It's not pride. Also, sometimes when we think about meekness, we think that in some way it is weakness, and that is not good in our culture, right? I'm a dude. I'm told all the time that men are strong and men love Home Depot and men do push-ups and men are tall and all those things that I really try to live into, but I'm just not. My voice is about an octave too high to strike the fear of God into anything, you know? So often, and my friends know this, I will be on a call with somebody and I will hang up the phone and the person on the other end will say, thank you, ma'am. And I'll say, awesome, right? When we think of meekness, sometimes it gets tied into this idea of niceness, or when it's translated gentleness, we think in some way that it carries with it a connotation of weakness. And that's hard for us. Because whether we want to admit it or not, we are a power-centric society. We use our power to influence those around us. We do it as America, as a country, and that filters down to the family unit. It really does. Even more so in the first century. So he's sitting on this mountain with these people, and he says, blessed are the meek. And under the Roman model of leadership, every father, every guy that was born a Roman citizen was his own little demigod. I maintain that being born a man in America is like hitting the genetic jackpot. It really is in terms of affluence, even if you're not affluent in our standards. Being a Roman man in that culture is the same thing. Nobody could harm you. Nobody could touch you. You got the benefit of the spoils of Rome, which controlled the known world at that point, and nobody challenged your authority inside your family units. Nobody. So it says in Ephesians 5, when it talks about power structure, it says that we're going to redefine what the family power structure looks like. And it looks like submittance and not power. So, for example, in the first century world, if you were a guy, you could honestly give your wife any order and she was supposed to, had to do it. You could beat your wife if you wanted to. It went to your kids. You could tell your kids to do whatever you didn't want them to do. And they kind of, their world revolved around your happiness. So much so, one of the best and most sad examples in the first century world is if your wife gave birth to a kid, they would put the kid down on the floor and it wasn't a part of the family till the dad picked it up. And so if the dad didn't want the kid because it had a kind of defect or it had some kind of deficiency, or some authors will note, if it was a girl and he didn't want a woman, they would put the kid outside of their door and leave it there until somebody else picked it up or it died. That was what it was like to be a man in that world. It was power-centric around you. And Jesus steps into that and says, blessed are the meek. And so what we do is we relate this idea of meekness with weakness. But a couple things that we have to know and know right now is meekness in no way is weakness. It's how we deal with our power. Because it says that Moses was meek. It also says that Jesus in Matthew 11 is meek. That word humbleness or gentleness in Matthew 11, when he says, my yoke is easy, that word is meekness. And two examples that I know of off the top of my head are when Moses comes down the mountain and he sees in Sinai people that are not worshiping the God who delivered him. He takes these stone tablets, his face is shining, he slams them on the ground and he says, a bunch of you people are about to die right here, right now. And they did. Read it. And Jesus, he's walking into the temple, the place of God, so that people might experience the presence of God, but they're using it for their profit. He walks in and he's so distraught by that. He starts flipping over tables and he raises all hell in a place where people are supposed to get a glimpse of heaven. Meekness is in no way weakness. It's in no way not standing up for the things of God. It's in no way not saying that God can't one day stand up for himself. It's in no way saying that God doesn't have power or we don't have power as a church or as a people. The question about meekness isn't weakness. It's how do we use our power? A lot of writers and commentators will say, it's essentially the analogy of a horse. If you've ridden on a horse, I do it every once in a while. It's few and far between. They terrify me. Because this thing, at any given point, even though it might be broken, has way more power than I'll ever have. And it chooses when and how to distribute it. If you've ever been on a horse when it starts taking off and you don't want it to, hold on for dear life. Because you are at the whim and the fancy of that beast that's way bigger, faster, and stronger than you. I see it in Jesus, in John chapter, in Matthew, sorry, chapter 4. My favorite places to see it in the life of Jesus is when he, it's right before he goes to the Beatitudes. It's when he is going into the wilderness to be tempted. And so he goes into the wilderness for 40 days to be tempted, 40 days. And we look at tempting and we say it had to be hard because he was hungry and there's some bread. I think the tensest part of this story to me is essentially when the devil approaches Jesus and two out of the three times he says, if you are the Son of God. Because, spoiler alert, Jesus is the Son of God, and he was the Son of God then. And if he's the Son of God, he can do what he wants, when he wants, how he wants to do it. We don't dictate that. And so he goes into being tempted, and the devil comes up to him and says, if you are the Son of God, if it's me, everything inside of me wells up in that moment and says, let me show you who I am, because clearly you don't see it that well, you know? He says, if you are the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. And if you've ever been hungry for any given period of time, that can also control all your actions. I have a 7-week-old kid, and whenever she's hungry, our world completely stops, right? Hunger's a driving force. But if you are the Son of God, couple that with the hunger, couple that with he's questioning his very worth and or power, and he had it the whole time, that tension had to be incredibly difficult to stop and resist. But he didn't. Because in that moment, it wasn't about Jesus showing the devil what he was, or it wasn't about Jesus performing for Satan in that moment. What it was about was Jesus submitting to the will of the Father, because he understood the bigger picture of what's coming, because he understood the next 3 years, not 3-4 days, 3-4 weeks. And so meekness really is, when we talk about what it is, it's the ability to control yourself when you want to show others how much you can control, because that's what we want to do, is to show others how much we can control, how powerful we are. And if Jesus would have done that, it would have been fine. It wouldn't have been wrong for him to do that. It's kind of like, growing up, one of the places where I saw value in myself was just in sports. I love sports, played a lot of sports. I was okay at them, but you know, I liked them. And then I took a job here as a middle school youth pastor. I was all of 25 years old. And then you have these middle school kids that look at you like you're 25 going on 80, and they just don't think you can move anymore, you know? And so they'd say things like, I can beat you in basketball. And I would laugh at them, right? And I'm not great, but these kids were 12, you know? I mean, it just wasn't a fair fight. But all they saw was me, 25, going on 80. And they'd say, we need to play one-on-one. Once a year, we'd have a conference we went to at Pine Cove, and there would be a line of kids that I would play one-on-one with, time after time after time. I wish I could tell you in that moment. I really do. I wish I could tell you that these little kids that prodded me and said, you can't play basketball, you're old. I wish I could say that I did the right thing and I let them get a couple points and I built up and encouraged these kids for a love of basketball and Jesus. I didn't. I demolished them, right? I'm sorry. I absolutely demolished them. They were questioning my ability. I had that ability. And I said, you know what? You're not going to get a shot off. And they would walk away depressed because the person that says that Jesus loves them clearly wasn't very loving. And you're also really bad at basketball, right? That's Yes, and we said, oh, sorry. I mean, pray for my daughter. But the point is that in a moment when Jesus could have proved his control and his power, he said, I'm not going to, because it's not about me. Instead, in that moment, it's not about what I can control, but how well I control myself. There's a counselor, he's a marriage counselor, his name's Dave Harvey. He says, meekness has nothing to do with being weak or passive. It's power harnessed by love. In marriage, to be meek is not to be weak or vulnerable, but to be so committed to your spouse that you will sacrifice for his or her good. And that's what happens in Ephesians 5. He says, it's not about you, it's about sacrifice and submission. Even if you have all the influence in the world, blessed are the meek. This is the systems, the rhythms of my family. And really, it's something we get to exercise every day. It says it in Galatians. It says a really beautiful description of how meekness affects the relationships of those around me. Brothers and sisters, if a person is discovered in some sin, you who are spiritual, restore such a person in a spirit of gentleness. That word gentleness, again, is meekness. So when we talk about what meekness looks like and what power and influence looks like in our world, I can think about it in my marriage. I can think about it as a parent even now. I can think about it as a pastor because you wield influence and power over people. I can think about it. But what I have to do is ask the question, what am I using my power for? It's that battle that we fight between grace and truth. You know? Because as Christians, there's this tension that I need to speak the truth, but I want to do it graciously. And where do we draw that line? It's kind of like, have you ever been in a situation where somebody is probably, let's just, doing something wrong towards you, or doing something in a way that isn't uplifting, or just being wrong in their wrongness? And you leave, and 30 seconds after you leave, you say to yourself, man, why couldn't I have thought of that and said that then, 30 seconds ago? You ever been in that situation? And then there's one time when you've had your coffee and the stars align and everything's going well for you that day, that on that moment you actually do it. And in that moment you actually say everything you want to say and think, even if it's justified, it has the opposite effect of what you hoped and thought it would. And you walk away feeling worse than you would have if you walked away and hadn't said it. Blessed are the meek. Meekness is not simply the idea that we can exercise our influence when and wherever we want, how and when we do it matters. So the difference between, the tension between grace and truth, sometimes we feel like if we don't yell truth at people, if we don't give our power and yell our power at people, that we are in some way sacrificing the truth of God. We're not sacrificing it, but when and where it matters. I'm doing some premarital counseling these last couple weeks, and one of the principles we instill is that truth is never an option, but when and where are optional. Because that's just a measure of grace. To talk to my wife and tell her truthful things, and her to me when I'm not tired and when I'm not hungry and we have a positive conversation about it, that's just maturity. And so when we talk about how meekness affects our community in every way, it affects how we talk to one another every single day, our attitudes and our actions. So meekness then is about how we control ourselves and not what we want to or think we can control. It's also the disciplined display of power for the purpose of others. It's being able to say in that moment that I could exert my influence right here, right now, but there's a bigger picture. But my love stops me from doing it. It's I could dominate this, that, or the other, but I won't, because I understand what loving looks like. So when it says in Galatians, restore one another with a spirit of meekness, it means may love guide your next move. And if it becomes not loving and more about you wanting to say your truth, maybe don't. So it's not about a lack of power, it's about a disciplined use of power displayed for the good of others to show them the love of Jesus. Blessed are the meek. It's what Jesus did all the time. And he ends it out by saying, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. And a couple things about this last phrase that I love. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. I think, I don't know if you guys have ever rented property, lived in a rental house, or if you own rental properties. I've done both. I lived in a rental house. I remember One of the games we like to play in the rental house that I lived was we had a downstairs big room, and then we had an upstairs bathroom right after the downstairs. And so we had this game of, on these wood floors, what if I took golf balls and we bounced them on the first floor all the way up to the second floor, and we tried to get it in the toilet bowl, right? My roommates and I played this game for hours, you know, with no care for what that floor looked like when we got done. My dad had rental houses growing up, and the worst thing was when somebody moved out of the rental houses, because they did not treat those things well. And guess who was the cleanup, paint, pool maintenance, fence repair crew? This guy, right? I've seen people leave things in terrible repair because they're renters, they're not owners. My point here is simply, God says in the kingdom of God, in the family of God, you're not renting space, you're co-heirs with him. You are owners with God and his kingdom. And that changes how we talk about Jesus. It changes how we treat this space. It changes how we treat our family. It changes things because we all tend it together. We take care of it together because we are owners with God of his family. So he says, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. When he says earth there, he's kind of using a term, a cultural currency that they would understand, because that's what the Jews wanted. They wanted the space that their butts were sitting on right then and there. They wanted to own it. And they're afraid. Their biggest fear was, if I'm meek, how can I exert my power to get this back? They're afraid, like pushing rushing water, that I'm going to do this thing, but it will not, cannot, never will get me where I'm going. And I need to hold on tighter and exert more power and influence, because it's the only way I'll get what I want. And Jesus says it's just the opposite. Blessed are those who disciplinedly display their power for the good of others, because in the end, they will see what they want come to fruition. They will, in this sense, literally inherit the earth. It's kind of this idea of what we've talked about each week, which is the Beatitudes has a here and now application, and it also has a far away application of one day God will. It's what we mean when we say the family of God, the kingdom of God, is already but not yet. We see its influence in our world, but it's not done impacting. Where one day will impact all things all the time. It will be in full. And so the here and now, what is meekness? It's a disciplined display of power for the good of others, that they might see the love of Jesus. And then one day, ultimately, God will do that for all of us. It's Psalm 37. I want to read you just a couple verses from Psalm 37, because what Jesus talks about in Psalm 37, what the writer does, David, is he talks about a bigger perspective of meekness beyond just the here and now. And it goes like this. Let me read a couple chapters or verses. Don't fret when the wicked men seem to succeed. Do not envy evildoers, for they will quickly dry up like the grass and wither away like plants. Trust the Lord and do what is right. Settle in the land and maintain integrity. It says, commit your future to the Lord. Trust in him and he will act on their behalf. Verse 7, wait patiently for the Lord. Wait confidently for him. Do not fret over the apparent success of a sinner, a man who carries out wicked schemes. Don't be angry and frustrated. That only leads to trouble. Verse 9, wicked men will be wiped out, but those who rely on the Lord are the ones who will possess the land. Same phrase that Jesus is using. And what he means there is that not only are we meek to one another, not only do we use a disciplined display of our power for the good of others, that they might see the love of Jesus, not only is that what meekness is, but that's what God does for you and me every single day. Because you might ask the question like I do, like we've asked over and over in the last 6 months, it's a theodicy question. It's the number one question against Christianity. If God is all good and God is all powerful, then why is there evil in the world? He's either not good enough to fix it, doesn't want to, or can't because he's not powerful enough to fix it. Both of those would be problems, but there's a third solution to it. God is meek. Because here's the deal. If God displayed all his power against sin and evil and injustice right here and right now, he'd start with me. Blessed are the poor in spirit. He'd start with me. If God displayed his power against the things that he hated, the sin in this world, he'd start with all of us. So what the meekness of God is him saying, you know what? I'm not going to do it right now. I'm going to postpone displaying all of my power so that for the good of, you might know that I love you. So every day that passes and the world is unjust, and every day that passes, and I have that question of, is God still good? What he's saying is that's another day for people that they might come to know that God is good and trust in Jesus. It's the meekness of God displayed, the disciplined power of God. It's a beautiful concept that God is meek, and so we then walk in that meekness as well. It's the fabric of what holds us together, that it's not about us and that we don't use others to build ourselves up. It's this disciplined display of power for the good of those around us as the family of God. And it's hard because I don't know if there's a 10-word answer to what meekness is. I think it's a concept and it's nuanced and it's something that you see and you know when you see it. And my hope and my prayer is not that maybe we have every ability to define it word for word because life is messy. My hope and my prayer is that through seeing the impacts of meekness from God to us and then us to the community around us, maybe we pursue it more steadfastly like the big ones, like love, joy, and peace. Maybe there's a reason why Jesus says when he's first talking to the community, blessed are the meek. Maybe I can ask myself the question of how I model meekness because that points to how Jesus, God, is meek with me right now. And people see the goodness that is the family of God. So we're going to end today with communion because Andy referenced it earlier on. I don't know of a better display of meekness than Jesus on the cross. I just don't know it. There's a theologian and an author I love. He says it like this. His name is Peter Kreeft. He says, to see what meekness is, you must look at meekness. You must not look at meekness, but at Christ. Saying meekness is this or that sends you to concepts which are pale copies of reality. Saying Jesus is meek sends you to the living reality of it. My point is simply in a word that's hard to describe, but a nuanced idea or concept. If you're ever doubting it, look at who Jesus is and what he did. And on the cross, he gets up there and he says, I forgive these people, and he says six other things. And one moment in that, it's kind of like the same thing with the temptations. You have these Roman guards that are trading for his clothes, and they're mocking him. He's dying for them, and they're mocking him to his face. And he's still the Son of God, which means he can what? Do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, however he wants. And they say, if you really are God, come down off that cross. And I'm telling you, if it was me, I would have came down quick, you know? But he doesn't. Because he looks at them and he says, you don't know it yet, but this is for you. And I could, but I won't. Because I see the perspective of God that's bigger. Meekness is a conversation about humility and power and perspective. One that shows us how God is meek towards us and has us model that in others. And so as we take communion, we remember that the sacrifice of Jesus is meekness on display. When he gets up in the room of his people and he says, here is my body that's broken for you, that's him being meek. When he says, here is my blood that's shed for you, that's Jesus being meek, displaying his power disciplinedly for the greater purpose. And at Crossroads, we do that too. All of our tables are gluten-free. We are not using the power of gluten for you, right? We're withholding that. But as we take communion together, we get to press into, to be reminded of meekness's beauty, and to hopefully, inside of a spur up, kind of this desire to run towards it and to be people that when they're defined as meek people are overjoyed that we get that one, you know? So let me pray. Let's take some communion together. God, I am in awe of the humility of Jesus, in awe that Jesus would not just use his power whenever and wherever and however he could and was and had the ability to do. I'm in awe of his meekness. I pray that as we dwell on a concept that's a little, well, just a little slimy, a little hard to grasp, that you show us what it is in our lives and where we need more meekness. I pray that as we take communion, that we're reminded of the beauty of Christ's disciplined display of power. I pray that we're reminded that because of that, we aren't renters of God's kingdom, but we are co-heirs, inheritors of all those things that are good. And may it lead to joy. May it lead to joy, and may it lead to this ability to show others what it looks like to be in the family of God. So I'm thankful for your sacrifice. I'm thankful that Jesus was meek. And I pray these things in his name. Amen.